This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In a few minutes, we go to two scientists with stuff we all need to know, I promise you. Harvard's Dr. Loretta Mickley has discoveries about how fiery this planet actually is. Do wildfires and those far-flung clouds of smoke heat or cool the place? Then another awful impact of overheating our house. The lakes around most Radio EcoShock listeners are heating up like everything else, and that means losing oxygen. Fisheries will be affected. From New York State, Stephen Jane explains new science on changing life in the lakes.
Sweat.
But first, we need to sweat a bit. People in the Middle Ages feared the sweating disease. It killed fast. Laugh in the morning, dead by night, the saying went. It killed kings and peasants alike. Now comes the new sweating disease. Our home planet is warming rapidly. Heat waves are signposts of global warming. They get hotter. They come more often, sometimes back to back. We've covered that in the show. They come later in the fall than ever, and now earlier in the spring. We had full summer here in late May in the West. That whole block of 100-plus degree heat, almost 38 degrees C, rode through the prairies, setting records to the East Coast, roasting everyone for days in early June. At the same time, the Middle East experienced a record even for those hot lands. Temperatures went over 125 degrees, 51 degrees C in several countries. It was by far a record for early June. Some called it the harshest spring heat event ever seen. Within a generation, that may be the new normal. NOAA, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, just announced even the pandemic shutdowns did not stop increases in dangerous greenhouse gas emissions. We are approaching 420 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. A few years into producing Radio EcoShock, back in 2013, CO2 in the atmosphere crossed a horrifying 400 parts per million. Scientists and anyone who is awake to climate risk were on a scale somewhere from worried to frightened. Adding methane and other potent greenhouse gases to that total, it felt like a tipping point where a wrenching shift in climate was getting to be inevitable. This week, the new safety barrier broken at 420 ppm is barely news. We have created a vast system of distractions, taking us away from a new invasion by heat, a growing ocean, and a long list of challenges, including a mass extinction of other species. Our favorite places, our safe places, will morph away, likely towards less life, for a long, long while. For a few years on this show, I complained about the unreality of officials discussing holding global warming at 1.5 degrees C by the year 2100. Maybe that was a valid hope in 1990, not after 2010. Finally, at least one global institution is ready to acknowledge that ship has sailed. The World Meteorological Organization, not really a radical group, they've updated their data. Now they say the world is likely to hit 1.5 degrees C warming by the year 2025, not by the end of the century, coming right up. In the next few years, even the cool years will be hotter than anything you grew up with, says the WMO. By 2025, we should also expect another record-hot year to beat the current holder of 2016. So this is it. Global warming is here. The climate is changing. We may be able to affect how much, how fast. That used to be a worst-case scenario. Now it's our best hope.
Climate dominoes falling. Open access. Published June 3, 2021, in Earth System Dynamics.
Interacting tipping elements increase risk of climate domino effects under global warming. That's the title. The five authors come from the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, or PIC, and the University of Potsdam. I want to read the abstract from that paper without the complex paragraph on methods. Here we go, from this hugely important new paper led by Nico Wunderling. With progressing global warming, there is an increased risk that one or several tipping elements in the climate system might cross a critical threshold, resulting in severe consequences for the global climate, ecosystems, and human societies. While the underlying processes are fairly well understood, it is unclear how their interactions might impact the overall stability of the Earth's climate system. As of yet, this cannot be fully analyzed with state-of-the-art Earth system models due to computational constraints, as well as some missing and uncertain processes, representations of certain tipping elements. Here we explicitly study the effects of known physical interactions among the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, and the Amazon rainforest, using a conceptual network approach. We analyze the risk of domino effects being triggered by each of the individual tipping elements under global warming in equilibrium experiments. Overall, we find that the interactions tend to destabilize the network of tipping elements. Furthermore, our analysis reveals the qualitative role of each of the four tipping elements within that network, showing that the polar ice sheets on Greenland and West Antarctica are oftentimes the initiators of tipping cascades, while the AMOC acts as a mediator transmitting cascades. This indicates that the ice sheets, which are already at risk of transgressing their temperate thresholds within the Paris range of 1.5 to 2 degrees C, are of particular importance for the stability of the climate system as a whole. That's an end quote from the abstract of that new paper. Damien Carrington, the environmental editor at The Guardian, filed his story on this breaking science with this: climate tipping points could topple like dominoes, warned scientists. Analysis shows significant risk of cascading events even at 2 degrees C of heating with severe long-term effects, end quote. Remember from our previous guests, a tipping point is not the destination, but the point where a significant change is inevitable and unfolding. In the example of Greenland ice cover, the tipping point would be almost total deglaciation of Greenland is unstoppable. Greenland has been ice-free at least once before in the last million years, we've heard that. The Thwaites Glacier melt in Antarctica is now unstoppable, says NASA. But does Greenland reach that tipping point before, after, or because of changes in the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, AMOC, and that includes the Gulf Stream? This new science investigates those interactions and concludes, quote, the polar ice sheets on Greenland and West Antarctica are oftentimes the initiators of tipping cascades, while the AMOC acts as a mediator transmitting cascades. Where would the cascade be transmitted, I wonder? As far as the Amazon? Africa? If a cascade of tipping points develops even during this decade, how would these large changes affect Indonesia or Mongolia? Everything in the Earth system is connected. I previously covered this issue in my show Disaster in the Making, Cascading Tipping Points and Permafrost. That was posted on January 8, 2020. Our guest, Professor Tim Lenton from the University of Exeter, was lead author of a comment in the journal Nature, and that was titled, Climate Tipping Points, Too Risky to Bet Against. One of their major stated worries was cascading tipping points. Now, this new study from the respected Potsdam Institute scientists shows this global disaster, unfolding over decades, could happen, even if the goals of the Paris Climate Accord were met, and they are not being met. We are all standing, my friends, in a busy freeway. Large forces zip by us at incredible speeds. Humanity will likely be hit by a truck if we don't get off the road.
Get off the road.
Get off the road. Get off the road.
We had terrible wildfires in so many places in recent years. California, the whole West, Australia, Canada, Siberia. So it is a shock when new science finds Earth was a smoky place even before the Industrial Revolution, and that could mean our planet may not warm to the very worst extremes shown in the latest climate models, or in some of them. We're fortunate to have reached a senior scientist at Harvard with expertise on wildfire smoke and climate change. Dr. Loretta J. Mickley is Senior Research Fellow at the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. Loretta is senior author in the new paper, and the title is Improved Estimates of Pre-Industrial Biomass Burning Reduce the Magnitude of Aerosol Climate Forcing in the Southern Hemisphere. Of course, we will talk about what all that means. It was published May 28, 2021 in the journal Science Advances. The lead author is a recent grad student, Peng-Fi Liu. Loretta Mickley, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
It is a record hot spring here in the West with developing drought. I smelled a little wildfire smoke outside my door last night. Wildfires have broken out in the U.S. and Canada early, smoke going as far as New England. The assumption has been that climate change is driving more fires compared to a tranquil time before humans started burning fossil fuels. Loretta, why did your team question that?
Let's begin with the Western U.S., first of all. And then I'll switch to the Southern Hemisphere, which was the focus of our recent paper. So in the Western U.S., there has often been very intense fires in the past. We can tell from charcoal records in the soil that during warm periods in the past, fire has really spread across much of the Western U.S. In recent decades, two things have happened. First of all, over the 20th century, there's been a suppression of fire. There was a real effort to allow people to move into lots of places in the West and to keep the West relatively fire-free. And that has allowed, I say relatively fire-free, that has allowed an accumulation of very dense vegetation to grow, leading to what is sometimes called a fire deficit. But along with this accumulation of fuel, the weather has become warmer and drier as a result, we think, of climate change. And that's another pressure on fires in the Western U.S. We know that fires need dry, abundant fuel to burn and to spread, regardless of who sets the fire, whether it's lightning or a human being accidentally starting a fire. What spreads the fire is this warm, dry weather that allows lots of dry, abundant fuel to feed the fire. So the recent increase in fire in the Western U.S. is due to a combination of factors, the accumulated fuel, but also especially climate change. And we think that the fires will continue to increase in future decades as the climate continues to warm. Now, going to the Southern Hemisphere, a big question was just how much fire activity there was in the past. And that's an important question because we want to understand how the climate has evolved over many centuries.
Why would you choose the Southern Hemisphere, which has less land mass and fewer people living there, and rather than the Northern Hemisphere?
For one thing, we had a really nice array of black carbon measurements in ice cores. What is black carbon? It's sometimes called soot. And we worked with a really magnificent ice core chemist named Joe McConnell, based in Nevada, who takes these long ice cores drilled out of the ice in Antarctica, and this also in Greenland, and he looks at how black carbon or soot has varied over the decades going back in time. And for this particular project, we wanted to look at the Southern Hemisphere because it's a much simpler hemisphere. There are fewer influences, less human activity, more of the natural world, we thought, going back in time. So we had this really nice set of ice core records that both Joe and others had captured over the centuries. And I want to show the plot of all of the ice core measurements that we used for this study, going from 1750 to the year 2000. And you can see there's a lot in gray, the interannual variability at each site. So here are all 14 sites that we looked at, and here's the time series of black carbon. The black shows a kind of running mean over a number of years for each of these sites. And you can see that many of the sites show loss of interannual variability, but generally fairly flat until you come to the late 20th century. And then you get this big increase. Some of them actually show decreases from the 1850s into the present day. So we were curious about that. We were wondering what's causing all this black carbon, all this soot. And soot occurs whenever you have some kind of combustion, either from home heating, or it could be wood burning, dung burning, or power plants, industry, diesel fuel, all of that leads to BC, or black carbon, or soot. And in the past and in the present, we have fires. So we know, given that there are relatively few people in the Southern Hemisphere in the 1700s, we figured most of that black carbon or soot was coming from fires. We didn't know what kind of fires, but we thought this must be a record of fire activity. And so we worked next with a chemistry model to try to capture this progression of black carbon or soot over time. So at Harvard, we've developed a very beautiful, in my view, model. It's been the work of many hundreds of scientists called GeoSchem, and it captures the chemical composition of air, all the particles, all the trace gases, and it works a little bit like a weather model. Only instead of having just weather moving around the Earth, we can actually capture the movement of smoke plumes, for example, or the transport of plumes from power plants. We can begin to see how the pollution spreads around the globe. And I really want to credit, you know, these hundreds of other scientists who have contributed to GeoSchem, including the lead developer, lead scientist, Daniel Jacob, my colleague here at Harvard. In any event, we tried to implement the standard emissions from fires, smoke emissions from fires, into GeoSchem. And we were not able to capture the trend of soot or black carbon from the pre-industrial era, 1750s, to the present day. So this picture here shows from 1750 to 2000. The ice core measurements are in black. This is the average over all 14 ice cores in Antarctica. And the gray shows the variation amongst these sites. And well, you try first putting a very standard scenario of soot emissions into our model from 1750 to 2000. And this is a scenario developed by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It will be used in the coming assessment report, the sixth assessment report on climate. And we found that our model did not capture any of this trend going back in time. There's lots of variability in the observed trend, but look, there's this big model measurement discrepancy. We weren't sure why. Now, you may ask, first of all, where is this biomass burning occurring, or where are these fires occurring? We know from other model experiments that these emissions are occurring in the Southern Hemisphere. Northern Hemisphere is just too far away, and the soot, the smoke will get rained out or get deposited to the Earth's surface long before it gets to the Antarctica. And we did some more studies, and we determined that much of the soot that reaches Antarctica is coming from the Southern Hemisphere, the southern parts of South America and Africa, and then present-day Australia and New Zealand. So that's where this black carbon is coming from. But there's no industry. There are no power plants back in the 1750s. all of this must be coming from fires, and yet we can't capture it with the standard emissions from IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So then we turn to a collaborator of ours named Jed Kaplan. Jed Kaplan has developed a really wonderful land cover model, a vegetation model, that takes into account the whole carbon cycle of growth and destruction and fires. And this model also takes into account the fire practices of indigenous people. We know that during this time period, there were many indigenous societies living in the Southern Hemisphere. And Jed has worked with anthropologists to understand the fire practices of these peoples. And indeed, there is much burning in their traditions. They use burning to clear the land for their agriculture. They use burning to clear the land to facilitate hunting. So our simulations using the new model that Jed Kaplan developed called LPJ LM Fire, we're better able to capture the evolution of fire going back in time compared to the standard IPCC CMIP-6 emissions. We get four times more black carbon, four times more soot in the past compared to the present day. What we get from IPCC is way underestimating what is going on.
Here is a strange thing, I think, for many of our listeners. In 2017, a team led by Neil Andela at Cardiff University published their paper, A Human-Driven Decline in Global Burned Area. It seems like farmers are burning less of their fields in the savannas and so on. And yet you're showing black carbon remains more or less the same or rising while forest area burned is going down. How does that work?
Yes. Okay. So what we think is happening is that in the recent decades, the paper you're talking about, the Andela paper, looks at just these decades here. And what we think is happening is that in the 20th century, as fire declined, the black carbon from industrial sources increased. So I should say this orange curve includes both fires and the industrial sources.
So fossil fuel emissions are picking up the slack of what might have been decreased soot from burning fires or wildfires.
Absolutely. So as the fire emissions decrease, there's an increase in the emissions from industry and power plants. And I want to say that the Andela paper that you referred to is really a wonderful paper. And what they see is a decrease in fire due in part due to passive suppression. What is passive suppression? That's the building of roads that can serve as fire breaks. And that's also the result of agriculture making, clearing out the fire-prone vegetation. So we call that passive suppression. And indeed, that has led to a recent decrease in fire activity.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Alex continues with Harvard scientist Loretta Mickley about Earth's smoky past and hot future.
Well, here in the village, I've lived in smoke so thick you couldn't see across the street. And it was cold and it was dark, even though otherwise, it would have been very, very hot during that time. It was a heat wave, but it was cold. So what I think many of the public are confused about is the smoke from wildfires a cooling factor or is it a heating factor regionally and then for the whole global climate?
That's such a good question. And this is the second part of what I'd like to talk about today is what are the effects of smoke on climate? How does smoke perturb climate? And smoke consists of an array of tiny particles, different kinds of particles, and gases. We focus mainly on the particles because we think they have the larger climate effect. I should also note fires release CO2, But that CO2, if it's a healthy biosphere, will be taken up again as the vegetation returns after a fire. So that's kind of CO2 neutral. A good fire, a healthy planet will release CO2 in fires and then draw it down again as the vegetation returns. So in addition to CO2, you have short-lived gases like ozone and other formaldehyde, other gases coming from fires. And then we have particles. We have very dark particles called soot or black carbon. And then we have lighter colored particles called organic carbon. And they have multiple roles in perturbing climate. When they're in the atmosphere, black carbon absorbs sunlight. Organic carbon reflects sunlight. Both of those processes, either absorbing sunlight or reflecting sunlight, lead to less sunlight reaching the Earth's surface. And that may account for some of the cooling that you've experienced out west when there's a fire nearby. So you get local cooling. The black carbon may actually warm the upper layers of the atmosphere because it's absorbing. So these effects, this first category of effects, is often called aerosol radiation interactions. And they kind of balance out because the black carbon absorbs and the organic carbon reflects. So overall, the temperature response tends to be neutral, although you may get cooling at the surface locally. But there's another very key impact that these particles have on climate, and this involves clouds. So as you know from your previous guest, Jessica Turney, clouds require water vapor, but they also require little particles that act as seeds for the water vapor to condense on. And if you don't have any particles, it's hard to get a cloud beginning to show up. So you get these little particles in the air, the water vapor condenses onto the clouds, and under the right conditions, the right temperatures, and right humidity, these cloud droplets can grow and grow and grow, and you get a cloud, a stratus cloud low or a cumulus cloud that billows up. And the more particles you have, the more cloud droplets you have, and the brighter the clouds are. And these clouds, especially low clouds, can reflect sunlight. And so downwind of the fires, as the smoke evolves, you can get clouds forming because they're providing little particles for the cloud droplets to condense on. This is way downwind of your village. So as you've learned from your previous guests, knowing cloud cover in the past has been very, very hard. Clouds don't leave a record. There's no proxy that I know of for clouds. There's no fossil record of clouds. They erase. So how do we know clouds in the past? Well, in our work, we tracked the smoke going from South America, Africa, and Australia, New Zealand. We tracked that smoke and determined what does that do to the cloud cover in the southern hemisphere? And then how will that cloud cover affect the whole hemispheric temperatures, not just locally, but the whole hemisphere? And we found that the particles produced by this more fiery past in the southern hemisphere led to an abundance of clouds, a little abundant cloud droplets that reflected the light. And so we have an effect on abundance of particles in the past that we didn't previously appreciate. An abundance of particles, an abundance of cloud droplets that led to greater cooling. We might have had a greater cooling effect than we thought. Now, going forward, I think we know the temperatures pretty well in the past, but we had a greater cooling effect from the clouds. Going forward, most models say, oh, not much cooling from particles until we get to the present. All of a sudden, we have the big industrial revolution, and all the particles ramped up. So we have this huge cooling effect. This is a standard view. We have this huge cooling effect in the present day. At the same time, we have this huge greenhouse gas warming in the present day. And in order to account for, to explain the rise in temperatures from the pre-industrial to the present day, modelers have had to say, oh, well, the greenhouse gases must be very powerful. We need that big push to overcome that huge cooling from all the particles. Okay, however, we say we've had that cooling all along. It's been fairly constant. So when the greenhouse gases come in, we don't need a big push for them, from them, to account for the warming due to greenhouse gases. We don't need such a sensitive atmosphere to the increase in greenhouse gases. Now, is this good news? Well, I'll come to that in a minute, but let me ask if you have any questions.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Alex continues with Harvard scientist Loretta Mickley about Earth's smoky past and hot future.
Well, I just wanted, before we run out of time, to insert the idea that this stuff is deadly as well. In February this year, you also co-authored a paper titled Global Mortality from Outdoor Fine Particle Pollution Generated by Fossil Fuel Combustion, came up with a figure of around 10 million deaths a year, which I would say is three times the official death toll for COVID so far, and yet we don't seem to be doing anything about it. What would you say about these fossil fuel particles that are killing millions of people?
These are indeed estimates, and I should say in 2018 we amended that to be 8 million given the decrease in particles from China. These are particles from fossil fuel combustion, not from fires. So it's a different class of particles. So why aren't we doing more about that? I think there's an awareness, there's a lack of awareness of the impact of fossil fuel combustion on human health. It's a very tough problem because many countries want to have electricity. They want to have cars, including us. You know, we want to develop. We want to mine Bitcoin. We want to have a comfortable life. We have this huge amount of fossil fuel combustion that leads to particles in the atmosphere as well as CO2. Our hope with that paper is that people will recognize that in addition to the dangers of greenhouse gases, there's a danger from breathing the accompanying particles that are produced by fossil fuel combustion, and that we should probably consider that as a very real and present danger of such combustion.
Okay, well, let's return to your new article. And you were hinting that maybe there's some good news in it, or maybe not. Why don't you let us know, what should we think about this? Because it's very complex here. Despite the TV news, fires may not be any worse. They could be a warming feedback. Millions of people are dying from air pollution. It's a lot to take in. So how do you summarize what your findings mean for us now?
So one of the big uncertainties is, how will the climate change in the future? What will increasing levels of CO2 do to our daily lives? And that's a very hard thing to predict. And our work, we hope, our work on the pre-industrial atmosphere, we hope will give a little bit more insight, help us pin down the true sensitivity of the Earth, of the Earth's surface temperatures, to increasing greenhouse gases. That's our hope. But there's a lot of uncertainty in how the Earth's surface temperatures will respond in the future. And we hope that by providing a little bit of a window into the past, we can better constrain what will happen in the future. And I want to make clear that although our work does not suggest these very high sensitivities that some modelers see, we still face really important decisions and a bleak future if we don't rein in the emissions of greenhouse gases.
From the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences at Harvard University, we've been speaking with Senior Research Fellow Loretta J. Mickley, and you can find links to all the science we talked about in my show blog published weekly at ecoshock.org. Loretta, thank you for helping us out. I'm sorry we ran out of time. We could have talked for a long time and still learned from you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Covering the world. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We know dead zones are increasing in the ocean as the world warms. What about our lakes? New science finds lakes are also losing oxygen, and maybe that will reduce the habitat for fish and other living things. But it isn't easy to figure out how over a million world lakes will respond to climate change. Even as he worked towards his PhD at Rensselaer Polytechnic, Stephen F. Jane was publishing his results, studying lakes in the United States. The latest work goes global, and the news is not good. From Troy, New York, Stephen Jane, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, as we speak, though, most of the northern U.S. is cooking under a record heat wave, and surely that hot must hit the Great Lakes and all the smaller ones. We know the ocean is slowly getting hotter. Steve, are lakes heating up as well?
Yes, we found the majority of these lakes have increasing surface temperatures, and that's not a new finding. There are several other studies that have found the same thing. So it's pretty well known that at least the surface temperatures are increasing.
We're going to talk about the deeper waters in just a minute, but the new paper from your team is not really about lake temperature, but about the amount of oxygen down there. What has that got to do with global warming?
The idea behind this paper was that we know that lake surface temperatures are increasing, and just by pure physics, dissolved oxygen should decrease in water as temperatures increase. So for us, it was a very simple, it seems like this should be happening in response to what we know are warming lake temperatures. So do we actually see this happening? I guess I would say it's a quite compelling indirect evidence of the effects of warming.
Okay, so you chose a bunch of lakes where there were records, some of them going back to World War II, but at least decent records so that you could see a trend and what's happening from then until now. And before we get into sort of your methods and what you did, can you summarize the results? Like, what did you find is going on in lakes?
We found that in surface waters, dissolved oxygen is declining at a rate that's roughly 0.11 milligrams per liter per decade. And that decline, we find, is related to that solubility effect, so that as the surface waters, the temperatures increase, there's just less dissolved oxygen that the water can carry. We're seeing a similar decline in deep waters, but it's not directly related to temperature. Now, when we talk about a similar decline, because dissolved oxygen is generally lower in deep waters, the percentage of that decline as it relates to the amount of oxygen there is greater in deep waters. And what's happening in deep waters is that we're seeing those surface temperatures are increasing, but deep waters are essentially unchanging in temperature. And so you're getting this increased difference in temperatures. And in water, density is related to temperature. So what happens is you get increased resistance to mixing. So in lakes, in deep waters, oxygen gets replenished from the surface. But if you get that increased density, sort of acts to like screw or tighten down a cap on a container, you could say. So that the greater that density, the tighter that cap. And so the less opportunity for that deep water to be reoxygenated. One other thing we found that was kind of counterintuitive at first is that there's a subset of lakes that tend to be nutrient polluted, and also relatively warm, so above a temperature range of roughly 24 degrees C, in this subset of lakes, we tended to see increasing surface dissolved oxygen. And this is happening in a temperature range that favors cyanobacteria, which can produce toxic compounds. So we believe this is evidence for increased blooms of these types of cyanobacteria as surface temperatures warm to temperatures that favor those organisms.
Right. It's not a simple picture. We're not going to find a sliding scale. Here's climate change. Here's what happens, because humans have so many other changes that we're making to the lakes. I know around here in British Columbia, where there's logging, the lakes are getting a lot of extra organic matter put into them, and I imagine that that changes the formula as well. So is that a factor? Are lakes getting clearer generally, or does it matter what humans do around them?
Lakes are situated in a watershed, and they're sort of at the low point in a watershed, which is why they're there, right? Because water just will go to the lowest point. And so lakes receive everything from the surrounding watershed. And so if there is any kind of land use change, that is going to affect the lake. What you're talking about with logging would be something that can lead to a lot of what's called dissolved organic matter in a lake. And that will definitely affect deep water dissolved oxygen. It also affects water clarity, and it decreases water clarity. But what we found is that overall, lakes that were increasing in clarity were roughly similar in number to those that were decreasing. So that although in some lakes, declining water clarity likely explained lower dissolved oxygen, we found that the majority of lakes, there was that increasing density gradient. So overall, there's more lakes where that lower dissolved oxygen is a result of that increasing density gradient than things such as inputs of organic matter.
But we don't want totally clear lakes. I know when I was younger around Sudbury, Ontario, where there was a big sulfur-polluting mine, you could see right to the bottom in a pretty deep lake, but that's because it was dead.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I'm from the Northeast U.S., and so there's a legacy of acid rain in that part of the world. And that is an effect of acid rain, that the lakes become extremely clear because there's loss of the plankton, all these kinds of organisms that tend to add some color to the water. But you also get, when that acid rain happens, you tend to get less dissolved organic matter entering the system. So that's another example where, yes, land use, or I guess that's more what's happening in the watershed, is going to affect the lake.
Well, on that, here's a bit of a puzzle for me from the paper. You found that, quote, deep water temperatures have been almost stable since observations began, and yet you predict, quote, declining habitats for many cold water species, end quote. Why is that?
Because although those temperatures are relatively unchanged, we're talking overall. If you're talking an individual lake, that may not be the case, but in the broad picture, even though those temperatures in the deep waters may remain relatively cool, so a trout might still like the temperature there, if you get less dissolved oxygen, generally those organisms that are really cold water species tend to require highly oxygenated water. So if you reduce the oxygen, even though temperature might not be changing, if it gets below a level that organism cannot tolerate, then you lose that habitat.
Well, we've got probably several million people around the world who either like to go fishing for sport or depend on it for protein, or even there are some fisheries off of lakes. So are your findings significant enough that we, if it continues on that trend, we could expect some harm to global lake fisheries?
It suggests to me that's something to seriously consider, especially for cold water fishes. You're likely to see reduction of habitat. I mean, we don't know how far this is going to go. We don't know if that habitat is going to completely disappear, but you're likely to get reduction of habitat. And in the case where that deep water goes completely anoxic, which happens in a lot of lakes that have inputs of nutrients, et cetera, then you pretty much cut that habitat off for most species of fishes, right? So if you have a system that's sort of sitting at that borderline, and then you just add this new stressor, then that could potentially cause a real problem for some lakes.
Well, taking that to the extreme, I recall a story told by Dr. Peter Ward from the University of Washington. He was interested in looking at causes of past extinctions, but he was also a diver, and he was in a lake in Southeast Asia. I don't remember exactly what country, but the waters were kind of purple. It had a foul smell coming from it. You definitely had to get on your breathing apparatus to get in there and dive. And what he found was that the organisms there had converted to a sulfur process system. They didn't require oxygen. And I guess there is that possible switch when lakes get really low on oxygen that maybe in the future they could switch like that.
In an anoxic environment in a lake, there are organisms. We have plenty of lakes in the U.S. that basically go anoxic in the summer as soon as you get below a few meters. And there are organisms living there, and they are anaerobic microbes for the most part, maybe some invertebrates. And yes, those use sulfur, forms of, I think, methane is also used. I'm not an expert in those types of organisms. But are you going to see trout begin to utilize sulfur? Or no, that's not going to happen. You know, so yes, there will be some types of organisms that can survive in there, but it's going to be a more microbial type things or some invertebrates, at least in the U.S.
Well, it sounds crazy, but could there be a geoengineering fix to save some lakes? Can we make them more oxygen friendly?
Well, I know that there are lakes where that's done, where there's artificial aeration and these types of things. I don't know how successful those things are. Like, is it how large a lake can you re-aerate? I'm not an expert on that engineering aspect. So I know those possibilities are out there. I don't think that type of solution is ideal.
It's not realistic. We've got so many lakes in so many places. There's no way we're going to send machinery out there and pump oxygen into them. We've got to avoid extreme climate change if that is a factor driving these changes in the lakes. I mean, that seems to be the obvious assumption.
That is an issue. If people would like lakes to remain as they currently are, yes.
You know, lakes don't get a lot of love from science compared to land, the oceans, the atmosphere, a lot more specialists in those. What brought you into this field of study, Steve?
Ever since I can remember, I've just loved fresh waters. It's not just lakes, but rivers and streams. I mean, I grew up fishing. I'm a fly fisherman. I don't know. It's just always been an attraction. That's the thing that got me into this field.
Sounds like a good job if you get to go out and visit lakes, but I'll bet you spend a lot of time in a lab or an office just computing all this data.
I spend a lot of time on a computer, yes. You don't do a study of 400 lakes, 24 years of data without a lot of time on a computer.
The lakes I notice in your study are from the Northern Hemisphere, nothing really from South America, Africa, Australia, and I'm presuming that's because you just didn't have the years of data required to compare decadal changes. Is that the case?
Right, right. So the only way to do this type of study is to have long-term data that's out there and available. And just because of the way the science has developed, it tends to be Europe and North America that have that kind of data. We had a few lakes from New Zealand, one from Japan, and we did have a couple in Africa, but we did not really include them in the study because the data set was so heavily contained mostly temperate lakes, so it didn't really seem to make sense to have one or two lakes from Africa.
So from this study, we can't really tell what's happening, say, with lakes at the equator. That's not what this is about. We're talking about temperate.
Correct. These are temperate lakes. What I can say is that generally, the further you get from the equator, the more extreme the temperature changes have been. And so this likely is, I would venture to guess that this is occurring in places north of the temperate zone. And it's certainly relevant for the equator. I mean, just the surface waters, it's just pure physics. If you raise the temperature, you're going to have lower dissolved oxygen. So the principles in the paper should be transferable to other locations. But, you know, because we don't have that data, we're just going to make statements about the temperate zone.
From New York, we've been speaking with Stephen Jane. He's the lead author of the new study, warning oxygen levels in world lakes is on the decline as the planet warms. The paper published in June 2021 is titled Widespread Deoxygenation of Temperate Lakes. You can find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Stephen, thank you for helping us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org.
Now to the heat wave, which continues for millions. It feels like 90 degrees from New York to Minneapolis. And that's where we find ABC News senior meteorologist Rob Marciano, who's also tracking some dangerous storms. What are you seeing, Rob?
We've got it all, Lindsay. Here in Minneapolis, we broke a couple of heat records today, reaching a high of 96 degrees, making it the earliest seven-day stretch where we got up and over the 90-degree mark. And I think tomorrow we're gonna make it eight. Take a look at these numbers. This unfortunately is climate change in your face with humidity levels. It's going to feel like 100 degrees here in Minneapolis. Sioux Falls up and over that, and Pierce, South Dakota, they've been baking. Lincoln, Nebraska, Wichita, all the way down to Oklahoma City. It's got at least one more day of this heat.
Wait. Rob Marciano said what? On the nightly news?
This unfortunately is climate change in your face.
July the 6th, 2021. Express UK. UK heat wave forecast. Charts turn red as 28C scorcher to hit in days. Britons are set to be scorched by searing heat, as long-range forecasts predict a sweltering heatwave.
Record heat bakes Middle East as temperatures top 125 degrees. It has been called the harshest heatwave in history for this time of the year. Five countries reported temperatures exceeding 122.
Canada's warming at roughly twice the global rate, part of us being a large, you know, northern country. And so that means, you know, around 1.5 degrees of warming globally actually means 3 degrees of warming here in Canada. And in fact, even more warming in winter. On average. And so, you know, if we stay on the current climate trajectory, I mean, we're really, Canada's going to be a very unrecognizable place.
June 9th, hot weather in Islamabad. 20 school kids fainted.
Schools closed in Lahore, Pakistan due to the heat.
June the 9th, Pakistan. Due to hot weather and frequent power cuts, people throng to Mandir River.
Radio EcoShock.
Reverend Billy and the Church of Stop Shopping Choir sing about the heartbreak of extinction, as played in their new Extinction podcast.
Oh, you animals. Extinction, it's here. Oh, but I'm worried, I just don't know.
I don't know if this will be the summer when extreme heat reaches billions of minds, powering a global response. Nobody does. Sometime in the next few years, most people will know. Even the deniers will sweat and some will die like the rest of us. Instead of falling into a state of shock or despair, these could be the great bad years of human history. The tide of humanity could turn or it could be washed over. I admire listeners who can tolerate the awful truth. Thank you for hanging in with me as we explore the deep past and the long future. We're trying to catch up with that ribbon of now. It's always escaping from us, falling away. During this summer in the Northern Hemisphere, coming shows will feature the best of what we know about heat, humanity, and a rapidly changing world. You will hear the experts. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, June 8, 2021.
What we're working towards is a smarter, greener, more resilient New Zealand. There is so much to gain. New jobs and opportunities for Kiwi businesses, lower household energy bills, a more sustainable agricultural sector, less air pollution, an enviable global brand, warmer, drier homes, exciting new technologies, protection of native species and ecosystems, cost savings for businesses, and overall resilience. If we do it right, we'll leave the economy stronger than we found it, And as Minister Shaw likes to say, a planet that's better off for what we did.